Hi everyone, I'm Jennifer, the host of Ikigai with Jennifer Shinkai, where we're going to talk about the Japanese concept of Ikigai, or living a life of purpose. Here you're going to hear inspirational stories from all different types of people who are finding their own life of purpose. You're going to hear about how they found their Ikigai and what they do every day to live an integrated life. So without further ado, let's dive right in.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to Ikigai with Jennifer Shinkai. I'm your host, Jennifer Shinkai, all snappily titled and nicely rhyming with Ikigai name, so well chosen. And I'm delighted to be here today with my guest, Elizabeth Hendrick, who I met very recently. Hi, Elizabeth. I met very recently at a networking event. I hadn't been out in ages. And I went to Four Empowering Women. It's a brilliant organization. They're having a career strategy seminar coming up in June, I think. Links will be in the show notes. And I went to this event and said, okay, I know there's going to be loads of people that I know, but today I am on a mission to meet three new people. And I actually met lots more than three new people, but one of the most impactful people that I met, Elizabeth, was you. And we met outside the toilets, where all the best conversations start, I believe. And we were chatting with another lady who had asked a great question after the panel. And you'd also asked a powerful question after the panel. And we were chatting away and you were telling me and the other lady who was with us about your book, Exidai, which you released in September of last year.
Right.
And it was such a fascinating story. I loved how that you kept saying it's not for the faint-hearted, which of course is red flag to a bull for a reader to go, am I faint-hearted or not? Let me challenge that. So I thought your marketing was fabulous. And I went home, ordered it. And when it arrived, I don't tend to read books that quickly. And I read it over the weekend. It was just inhaled. And what I took away from it, well, we're going to get into that today, but it's a very, very moving account. It's very different from my life experiences. And I was thinking, what is it about, because there are some, you know, very painful sharings in this memoir. What is it that is so compelling and was so inspiring for people to think about what their ikigai and their reason for being here means? And I wanted to talk with you about that, Elizabeth. So thank you. Welcome. And congratulations as well.
Thank you very much.
On releasing your memoir. I know it's always a challenging to get these personal things out into the world. But maybe what you could do is, in your own words, tell people a little bit more about your story and about the book to give a bit of background, and then we'll get into how this all connects to Ikigai.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for the introduction, Jennifer. And thank you so much for inviting me onto your podcast. This
Welcome.
Is really exciting for me. And it's actually really nice to do a podcast in the same hour for a change, because I've been doing lots of podcasts to promote my book. And I had to do one that started at 11 p.m. and it finished at 12:30 because that was in England. And I'm in Tokyo. And then the ones that I'm doing in America, typically I'm doing first thing in the morning. So 7 a.m., which is 5 p.m. Eastern time.
Right.
When I'm with the Pacific coast, it's a bit easier because they're a bit later in the day. So my last podcast was, I think, 8 a.m. and it was about 4 or 3 p.m. in the afternoon in Pacific time. Anyway, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be on your show, talk a little bit about my book. My name is Elizabeth Hendrick, and that's actually a pseudonym that I use for the promotion of my book. I basically wanted to keep some privacy for my family because this book has quite a lot of BDSM content, but it's not a BDSM romp at all. And it's really a story about how I came to terms with my sexuality. I'm British. I was brought up in England. I've lived overseas a lot, including France, including Dubai, Singapore, and now Japan. Japan is my utopia. And I tell people there are always five reasons, but the top reason actually is the efficiency. And the food is outstanding. It's the best in the world. But I think it's the efficiency that makes me love Japan so much. You go to England, there's leaves on the track and the train network goes down.
Wrong type of snow.
Exactly. Anyway, so a little bit more of my background. I was brought up in a really loving family. And my childhood from age 0 to 10 was basically bliss. didn't even know the concept of stress or trauma. I mean, as far as I can remember, we don't know what else might be in there, but I haven't gone there yet. Haven't seen need to dig too deep there. But as far as I remember, I was very happy and quite funny and mischievous tomboy. And I was attracted to girls. And when I was about 10, I sat down with a girl and told her that I loved her. And when I went through puberty, I was basically out. I never came out. I just was telling people what I thought about them. And my classmates at the time, this was an all-girls school back in the 80s in Norfolk, which is East Anglia in the UK. So very, very Christian values, very traditional values. It wasn't a Christian school per se, but we would sing a school hymn. We would say a prayer to God, the Father, the Holy Spirit at the end of assembly. And it was very traditional, white Caucasian school. And therefore, me fancying other girls in the class was a bit peculiar, but it was when we hit puberty that it became a problem, because there was this idea that once my period started, I would become a woman and start fancying men. And when that happened and it went round the class that I'd started periods and that on the tip of everyone's tongue is, how do you feel about Alexandra now, who was the girl I had a crush on at the time? And the resounding response, so when I said, I don't feel any difference, like having a birthday, it's just another day, I still adore her. And that was when they came back and said, well, you've got a problem.
Oh, wow.
There's something wrong with you. And it was completely alien. It was that word problem that really stuck in to my psyche. Anyway, so I internalized all of that from my adolescence. I was never abusively bullied, but it was just a kind of ostracization. And so my book in the cover page, you know, how we all have a who the book is dedicated to, mine just says, for those who have been ostracized. Mm. And it doesn't have to be because of your sexuality. It could be your color. It could be your height. It could be your shape, you know, whatever. So that's really set me off on a life carrying this internalized shame and guilt.
Mm.
And I basically thought I had accepted my sexuality when I was about 27, and I came out to a priest, and he was a liberal-minded priest and told me it was okay to be gay. God is the potter, you are the clay. But I had accepted it consciously, but I hadn't accepted it subconsciously. So my subconscious was still hardwired to attract punishment. I was guilty at a very deep cellular level. And so all of my relationships were defunct. And I kept blaming the external world. I was in this complete denial. Anyway, so I that's a very long answer, but this is really what the book is about. It's coming to terms with my sexuality. And I mean, in parallel, I was a very, very good, happy friend, a member of my family, a good student at school. I was naughty, but not in an evil way. I was quite hardworking. I did all right at school. And I got into financial services after leaving. I did a mathematics degree at university. Yeah. Funnily enough, became an author. But I think sometimes mathematicians become good writers because they're very succinct with their sentences and they're not too erudite and not too ethereal. Ethereal.
Oh, or ethereal.
So anyway, I was in financial services, and most of my life, everything was going tickety-boo, but this one huge part of my life in the area of love and relationships was just totally defunct from the get-go. And I was in denial that there was a problem. And it wasn't until 2007 when I went onto a reality TV show and got booted off because I did so badly and hit rock bottom. It wasn't until then that I finally realized that I had a problem and I needed to do something about it. And that's kind of the first half of this book, what I've just explained about my sexuality, why I hated myself, how it manifested in adult life, and when I first acknowledged there's a problem with me. I do not love myself as a lesbian woman and I need to fix that. And so from 2007, I began this 7-year journey of self-healing, which ended with 2 years boot camp at the foot of a Japanese dominatrix who was an incredibly sadistic narcissist, who took me through incredible physical, but more importantly, mental torture till I was at the absolute zero of oblivion, of surrender, of nothing, of total self-esteem gone. And somehow from that position, I managed to pull together the strength to lift myself up from my bootstraps and start to learn to love myself. So it was a sort of 7-year process ending in this boot camp, this really torturous relationship with this Japanese dominatrix. And the book goes into that 2-year relationship in the second half in very great detail. And this is why the book has trigger warnings, because people have likened me to Stephen King in the way I write about some of the abhorrent torture that I went through. And it's not particularly sexual. There's very little sex in this book. Yeah. Some people have, so when I initially put it up on NetGalley, which is one of the platforms where you can get reviewers to come and review your book. When I initially put it up, I put it as under one of the genres called erotica, but it's kind of, because it's got BDSM, people automatically think it must be erotica, but it's not really erotica because you're not getting staunch, hot, sexy, steamy love scenes in here. I mean, there's a bit of lesbian sex, which is a bit steamy, but it's just a sprinkling in the earlier chapters whilst I'm coming to terms with my sexuality still. But in the BDSM is about love, and it's about how I surrendered to this woman because I thought I had a mission to save her. And that's what kept me in the relationship when it became so obvious that the relationship was toxic for me, dysfunctional, ruining my life. Everyone around me was saying, leave her. And I thought, no, I have to take this. I have to suffer for her because I'm going to help her release her demons. And I became absolutely obsessed with this and completely enchained myself to this relationship, which is so bad for me. However, because I applied love and forgiveness to every diabolical situation, the love and forgiveness eventually came back to me. It just, if you apply love and forgiveness to any situation, you will grow. You will grow through that situation, no matter how toxic that situation is for you. And eventually that love came back to me and I started to see the light and I started to see I lack self-love. I'm not confident in myself. I'm trying to get recognition from a woman who is the last person to give me any recognition. I need to find it in myself. And how I came out of that relationship and how I started to see the light and some of the things I did, a bit of regression therapy, past life regression therapy, it's all in the book. And it's just that we go on the journey, the reader goes on the journey with me. But the torture scenes are definitely in need of several trigger warnings.
Yes, there was a
couple. I'm going to stop and give you a chance.
Yeah, no,
to
there
talk,
was a couple of
Jennifer,
moments
sorry.
In the torture scenes where I was. But what I found more torturous, as you shared, was the emotional part of it. And it's interesting that when you talk about now, and of course in the book, you talk about this idea of like, I was going to save her. And I think it was that piece which really triggered me to think about, well, this is like a form of ikigai for Elizabeth. This is her reason for being. This is what gets her out of bed in the morning. Like this, the character, I don't want to call character, but is named as Tomo in the book. So let's use as Tomo. Like, I'm going to save Tomo. This is what it's for. And it brought to mind some of sort of the dark side of ikigai when we can get into obsession or into a kind of addiction where we're unable to see the other parts as only one thing and it becomes kind of all consuming. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what that experience was like. And then sort of where, how you've changed and where you are now.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about ikigai and life purpose, because when I was in the thick of that relationship, I thought it was my purpose to serve and save this lady. And all the trauma that I was feeling, I thought was because I was relieving it from her on a psychological linked level. And that's what I thought I was doing. So for me, it was always the noble course to stay in the relationship and suffer the slings and arrows that she threw at me. And although that probably wasn't my life purpose. It was what I needed to keep me stuck in the relationship and keep me getting out of bed every morning and going and serving her and dropping everything. Everything. There's one scene in the book where I've just lost my biggest deal at the office. I mean, I'm working whilst going through this relationship. And there was a kind of an understanding. She couldn't call me on errands if I was working. You know, we did it outside in our spare time. But needless to say, I was only paying lip service to my work and it really suffered. And this huge deal had fallen through and I was just, I was absolutely financially exhausted. I was maxed out on all my credit cards. One credit card, which was according to me being resident in the UAE in Dubai where I used to live, and I wasn't anymore, and it was still functioning because HSBC hadn't caught up with me. I mean, I was in such a perilous position, and I had just lost this deal at the office that I was dependent on. And I went home and I'd consumed half a bottle of wine, but probably a whole bottle of wine in those days, and gone to bed. And at 12:40 in the morning, my phone started ringing. And it was Tomo saying, "Oh, I'm coming round to stay at your house. I need a place to stay in Tokyo. I'll be there in half an hour. Have you got any food?" And my icky guy would drive me to just drop everything, forget my woes, go to the convenience store, get the food she wanted, prepared it. I mean, I was on autopilot, but it was this motivation to keep serving her and keep serving her. It never failed to surprise me. It was there, and it would trigger and it would trigger. And I thought it was one of my life purposes. And I thought the book was going to end very differently than it did, because I was writing the book as I went through this relationship. I was keeping a diary because I thought, wow, this is so alternative. This could be an interesting story one day. Which takes me back to another ikigai, which was in 2012. I had just started falling in love with Tomo. And I was still living in Dubai at the time with on the beautiful studio villa with a beautiful view of the Persian Gulf looking over the beach. And I had started falling in love with her in 2012 because I'd visited Tokyo that year in April and I'd gone back a couple of times. And I was on the move to move back to Asia. I was looking at jobs in Hong Kong, Singapore and Tokyo, but it was Tokyo where the gravitational pull was. And during the process of deciding whether or not to move back to Tokyo, I used to read the Bible once or twice a week because I was actually quite a Christian. And at that time, I was pretty much 100% a Christian, believed that Jesus Christ was Savior and Lord. I don't actually believe that anymore. I try to be Christ-like, but I embrace all religions and I reject all religions. I'm spiritual. I believe there's a God, energy, love, life, consciousness, and things happen for a reason. But I don't think Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation. Absolutely not. Anyway, I digress. So I was a Christian and I was reading my Bible once or twice a week. And I used to have this pamphlet, A Word for the Day, that would help me explore a Bible passage. And on this one particular Bible passage that I read, I think, in November, December 2012, it explicitly talked about the story, I think, of Joshua. Now, Joshua was swallowed by a whale and went through all kinds of suffering before the whale spat him out, and he was able to go and tell the people, I think, Nineveh, about the glories of God, and he became a really applauded and happy person. Anyway, he went through this tremendous suffering. I think it was about Joshua. Sadly, I lost the book, and I've searched for it everywhere, but I lost some stuff in Dubai because the storage company turned out to be a scam, and I lost tons of my personal belongings. Anyway, I think it was hidden in there. So, but I'm pretty sure it was Joshua. And in this homily, the encouragement or the word for the day was saying, you may go through a lot of suffering and pain, but you will have a chance to write about it and tell people about it, which will help people in their own development. So it was almost saying, you're going to go through suffering just like Joshua, and you should write about it because it's going to help people in the future. And it was just so explicit. and the God hand pointing at me.
Yeah, wow.
This is your mission.
Mm.
And my relationship was just starting with Tomo. And I just knew it's talking about this relationship. This is a message from the universe. I'm going to go into this relationship and it's going to be horrendous. And I'm going to be absolutely tortured mentally and physically, whatever, pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And through that pain and suffering, because you're going to write about it, you're going to help people. So that really is what I think is my ikigai. And many, many times I think I was actually in this relationship thinking, I've got to write this book. I've got to keep a diary. I've got to write this book. And it almost got to a point where somebody actually said to me, do you think you're making these choices because you're writing a book about it and you want the ending that you want in your book? Or are you making these choices because those are the right choices in the circumstances and then you're writing about it? And it did get Ooh. To this point where the book writing was almost prompting some of my behavior because
oh, wow.
I was searching for this glorious ending, which didn't come, but I got a better ending.
Mm.
So the ending that I was searching for was this amazing, I hope, actually, this is a bit of a spoiler here for the book, but the amending the amazing ending that I was searching for, spoiler alert, put me on mute if you don't want the book to be spoiled, and I'll put my hand up again when the spoiler is finished. But I was expecting to go into this final session with this mistress and to have a really intense whipping and for her to break down and for her to suddenly release, because I was the only person who could give her the space and theater to do that and take the suffering that she needed to give to another person in order to relieve herself. And that was going to be the big ending of the book, the big Hollywood ending.
Yeah.
Oh, and
yeah.
she's saved and I've saved her and she loves me and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, the better ending is that let us not forget that we can only save ourselves. Yeah. We can only learn to love ourselves. We can help people along the way, but we don't save other people. We can only save ourselves. And because of my behavior and because of that relationship and because of my approach of love and forgiveness, I did learn to love myself and I saved myself, which is a much better outcome. And that's the real outcome of the book. Now, I'm waving my hand in the air. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler
over.
Is done.
You can put your
Come back
mute
in, everyone.
Button off.
So. We'll include that in. I really like what you shared, one, about, you know, the journeys and the challenges that we have. Sometimes I find myself asking all my clients who ask themselves, like, you know, why is this happening to me? Like, what is going on? Why is this happening to me? And I think that it's very interesting that you had this sort of this foresight, this forewarning, something's going to happen, but it's going to give you an experience and then you will be the voice and you will support other people through it. So sometimes the question is not like, why is this happening to me, but why is this happening for me? And how can I use that to help other people? It's an interesting kind of reframe that we can ask ourselves. And I also, you know, credit to your friend who said, hey, Elizabeth, like, what's driving these decisions? I think it's brilliant that you have people in your life who will challenge you like that.
Yeah.
And just to say, yeah, what's driving this? And also this, yeah, very important awareness about what we can influence, like what's within the sphere of our influence. And yeah, we can only save ourselves. What other people do with it, with what we give to them, what we offer to them, it's beyond our control.
Right.
We can have our
and
intentions.
I was trying to control
then,
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So very, very interesting on that. You've reminded me of another something we talked about in the planning conversation. And we talked about this 7-year journey. And if you'd known at the beginning when you got this homily and this thing that's like, by the way, this is gonna be 7 years. If you'd known at that time it's gonna be 7 years, would you have done anything differently? Or like, what, something about this time span and how long sometimes these journeys take?
Right. Well, so the 7 years was from 2007 to 2014. And those last 2 years, 2012 to 2014, were this 2-year boot camp relationship. 2007 was when I got kicked off the reality show, and I did a lot of self-work with counselors and stuff, but the real learning was that last two-year piece. Then there's a 12-year period which stems from 2012, when I got that initial calling, if you will,
right, yes,
to the current day, 2024. So there's 12 years now. So to answer your question, but it wasn't 7 years, it's 12 years.
12 years, right. So even if you'd known it'd been 12 years, yes.
If I'd known it would be 12 years to get to this point of having my book, my work published, and what I had to go through to get to that point, I don't know that I would have forged ahead. I mean, I still look back and I just think in 2015 when I pitched my first draft, and that was 8 years ago, 7 years ago, and 9 years ago.
Come on, mathematician.
So I know we mathematicians.
I know you don't do some
mental arithmetic because we've all got a calculator. You see, whereas artists don't have the calculator, so they have to do it in their head. Right.
So 9 years.
My mother's the best at mental arithmetic in our family, and she's a classics scholar, Latin and Greek. Anyway, she was a teacher. Anyhow. So the 2016, I pitched the first draft of my book, and I actually landed a reasonably good, probably second tier, a book agent in the US, but good enough that if he sent an email to HarperCollins that they would read it and reply. In the end, he wasn't able to secure a deal for me, but at that point, the book was still in its first state, which was just the story of Tomo. Eventually it became the whole story of learning to love myself and my sexuality, which is much more of a whole arc of a story, a finish and an ending. It was really just the first part in a tortuous relationship, and it needed to be broadened and finished. It wasn't even a finished story, but if at that point when that agent signed me up in 2015, if I had known at that point that it was going to be another 9 years, 8 years, because I published last year, eight years before you got the book out and were comfortable with its final draft, I would have just been overwhelmed with the journey ahead.
Yeah.
Absolutely overwhelmed. But I didn't know and just lived that journey. And I look back now and I think, crumbs, it was 12 years ago I got the inspiration to write this book. So it's very interesting the way life pans out, but it does make me feel, okay, I've been working on this book for 12 years and I can see myself working on it for many more years as I promote it and talk about it, and in fact it's even given me a platform now to talk about themes of learning to love yourself and how to self-heal and stuff, which is what I've always wanted to do. So you know, perhaps I'm starting to see the light on the horizon already without that many book sales. But if I had known that it was going to be that long, so sorry, I digress. I was going to say that because I've been that committed for so long, it does make me feel, oh yes, this is my life ikigai, or certainly one of my major life ikigais.
Yeah.
I'm still at it 12 years on. I mean, that takes dedication and commitment, and you can't fake that dedication and commitment if you're not really into something, if you're not passionate about it. Eventually, you give up. Because you're just not enjoying the journey.
Yeah, I just got little chills then when you said that. And I think what was coming up for me was, so often I feel I hear stories that seem very like overnight success. And for most of us, it's this actually plodding dedication, commitment, a little by little. And maybe there's some periods of time that you have where you do a lot, and then it goes through a lull, other parts of life kind of take over. I feel like I'm just actually projecting quite
That's
a lot of what's
right.
happening for me, but conversations I've had with other guests as well. So how did you keep going?
Just before I answer that, was it you that was talking about The Karate Kid? It may have been on one of the podcasts. Oh, did you ever see the movie The Karate Kid?
Of course.
The very first one.
Yes.
So he's,
oh,
he's
wax on,
made
wax
to
on,
clean
paint
that.
On. Yes.
Is he painting
the fence,
or is he putting varnish on it?
Something,
And he has to do this forever for like month. I know however long, let's say 6 months, whatever. He's doing this and he's trying, he's saying to his senpai, his master,
Mr. Miyagi.
When am I going to play karate?
Yeah.
And he says, when you're ready, it's another month yet. And then finally he does that and he goes, oh, and he's got all the moves because his muscles have been so well honed. And I think it's a bit like that with these 12-year journeys, is that you're honing muscles
Yeah.
metaphorically, you're honing muscles. That means that when you're sort of ready to put in that appearance and do the thing you were drafted to do, whether by fate, the universe, or your own inner self, you're ready. You're ready. Those muscles have been shapened up, and you're ready to go. Anyway, sorry. You then asked me a question which I've forgotten
I've
already. Can
also
you?
forgotten what it was as well, so we're back into
Yeah,
Karate
let me
Kid
have a
land.
sip of
But
coffee.
oh, I know what I asked you was. But I actually want to go back to that point. The question that I asked you was about like what kept you going. But I do
Oh,
think that's a
yes,
good
right.
reminder as well for people a bit like frustrated with the sense of progress. It might be a Karate Kid moment for you, and you are just building that muscle memory or like whatever it is that you need to be ready like when it happens. And it's just not now. But it'll keep, I just find for me, like different voices kind of keep coming up. I keep getting pulled back to things, and I hear it with lots of guests that it just keeps coming back. It won't go away. And that voice which is there. And then things happen because, for example, if yeah, you look at, so when did you say you did like 2016, you did the first pitch. It wasn't as easy, for example, to like self-publish in 2016, but it's still not easy to
You're
self-publish.
quite right.
But
I hadn't. Oh
the
gosh, I'm
world's,
getting thrills now.
oh,
Thrills,
oh,
thrills. Chills,
chills and
thrills,
thrills,
chills
love
and
it.
thrills.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that. You're right. Because you if I had self-published in 2016, I could have only self-published an e-book, I think. You see, this is print on demand from
Yes.
Amazon.
Yes.
It's print on demand. I could have done a hardback as well, but I didn't think that was necessary because hardbacks are for celebrities and well-known authors. You build up, bring out the hardback first, and then you go to the
Yeah.
paperback. I just went straight to paperback, but this is printed on demand from
Yeah.
Amazon, and it's cost me no money to upload all of
Yeah.
my manuscripts in Kindle format, in ebook format, and in paperback format. I mean, of course, I've had to pay lots of people to do the formatting and help me with the copy
And
editing, but the
editing and all of
actual
those things, yeah.
translate the transposition of getting my book uploaded onto Amazon and selling it is actually free.
Yes.
That's why there's so many bad books out there.
Including three of mine.
Anyway,
There you go.
no,
Yes,
not
yes.
yours.
No, but that's so sometimes that, the delay that we feel that, oh, I couldn't release this thing, or like it's not happening as fast as I want. Maybe technology can catch up with us and it gives us like a different way. Or as you said, like, for some people, perhaps they weren't ready to like tell their story in like a podcast interview. They might need to have gone through a bit more, or maybe people need to have media training, or just to be in a different place in your life in connection with your story or in connection with whatever this calling is, so that you can verbalize it, so that you have other life experiences that you can build on it. And sometimes when you're in the thick of it, that's not the time to be educating others. So you have a little bit of distance now as well, right? Which maybe in 2016, if you're pulled onto, I don't know, Good Morning America, maybe it wouldn't
Oh, I
quite
would
have
have
been
probably
right.
crumbled. Right, exactly. I also had no money back then as well. I had no security. I was living in the mountains,
Right.
in someone's. So I had friends in the choir, and a couple of them were millionaires and had repatriated back to Australia. But they had this chalet in the mountains in Yamanashi, looking over one of the lakes around Mount Fuji, with brilliant views of Mount Fuji, really close up. And it was just empty. I mean, they would rent it out to people in the summer for a couple of weekends here, a couple of weekends there. But it's one of these properties you just can't sell, because the places that old people are dying off, and the young kids and urban, they don't want to move out of town. So these places are just becoming derelict. It's very hard to sell, and their property was huge. So anyway, fortunately, it was 2015. But that's a detail. But in 2015, I was there for 6 months, from April to October, writing my book, and it was such a blessing to be able to be there. But at the end of that, I had no money, and the prospect of being, called to go on a podcast or being called to fly to America, go on a TV show or anything like that, I just couldn't have coped. I wouldn't have been able to stretch to it. Whereas I'm ready for that now. So if you're an American TV presenter, I'm waiting for your call.
There you go. You can contact. Links in the show notes for Elizabeth.
Yeah.
You can contact her directly there. That's amazing.
But
That's
anyway,
a
one step
really.
at a time. Podcasts first.
Yes. Who knows? Who knows where this will lead to? There we
Quite.
go. And I think the question that I asked was like, how did you carry on and continue? But I feel we've sort of talked to that.
Well, how did I keep going? Was
Hmm.
I think your question.
Yeah.
And I think it's belief. I believe that my book is important, and I believe it will help people. I know it already has helped people. I mean, if you go on to Goodreads or if you go on to Amazon and you look at the reviews, I think last time I checked on Goodreads, there were 90 ratings. And I did a calculation. 88% of those ratings, 88% are are 5 or 4 star ratings. And then there were 67 reviews. And again, majority 5 stars, followed by 4 stars, a few 3 stars, maybe one or two. One and two. There's 1 1-star rating, which is not very nice on Goodreads, but fortunately Goodreads has put spoiler alert over it, so no one's reading it. Haha. Anyway, these 5-star reviews, some of what people are saying is that they found the book really inspiring. They found it, I mean, particularly, I mean, there's older people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s are really getting the point of this book. And I'm thrilled, I'm honored, because these are people wise from experience, and they're saying this is a book about redemption. This is a book about the journey of the soul. And I think it's really touching people, and especially people in the LGBT community who find it relatable because it's the whole journey of struggling with your sexuality. People in the BDSM community are completely honing in on how, yes, BDSM can be a very dangerous framework for an abusive relationship, but it looks fine because in the context of BDSM, you look like that's what you're supposed to be doing. But I was in an abusive relationship without a shadow of a doubt. And I put myself there because my subconscious thought I needed to be punished. And she put herself there because we just plugged into each other on a codependent level. And she put herself there because she was a narcissist and wanted to see people suffer in order to experience love, wanted people to see people suffering. That was the language of love to her. And at the time, it was the language of love to me too. It was my quintessential expression of love, was to feel pain and suffer for the woman I adored. And it was all infatuation and addiction in the end. And I fortunately came out the other side. But what kept me going was the fundamental belief that I was on a purpose. And producing the book, belief that the book had meaning, and that this was a very important life work that I should complete.
And I love that you had this plot twist at the end as well, right? That you had believed that
Spoiler
this
alert.
life work was going, spoiler alert, everyone.
Sorry.
But you had believed that there was going to be a certain way that this would happen, what this ikigai, what this life's work was taking you towards. And then a total difference. So that's also teaching me that around that idea of the expectation of what the outcome might be. And am I driving too much for a certain expectation, which might not be the lesson that I need to learn from
Right,
this.
right. Yeah, they do say that life is something that happens whilst you're busy making other plans,
Yes.
and you can well be driving for a certain goal, when in fact that's not for you. That's not what the universe and your utter, beautiful, clean, abundant soul wants for you. And we will find out. Most in my case, I usually find out the hard way, but you find out. You find out.
Yeah. And now we were talking when we were having our planning about sort of where you are in your life right now and yeah, what's next? What's coming up for you?
Well, I think the next couple of years is going to be pretty much book promotion. I have had a lot of really positive feedback about Exodai, my book, and there is definitely space to write a sequel.
Mm.
And the sequel would be much more about the healing process. And I'm quite excited about writing about the healing process because I will get much more into how I learned to love myself and some of the dreams I had. But what I also was doing to keep myself healthy. And one thing in particular that I started doing was hiking in the Japanese mountains. And that is my new addiction, hiking. And when I typically go twice a month. And when I've not been for 3 weeks, I start to feel the mountains calling me. And I just can't wait. I'm going out hiking this weekend as it happens. And I just can't wait to go. I can't wait to get back into the mountains. And I always go to Saitama, because it's so convenient. I jump on a train at Ikebukuro and I take the train out towards Chichibu. Sometimes I go all the way to Chichibu, but between Hano and Chichibu, there are some amazing hikes. And I know that whole area so well now that there's another venture there. So it's taking people on guided tours, guided yes. hikes around Chichibu. But that's part of the healing process. So I think in the future, for me, I've had a lot of people tell me you are definitely a writer. This is your first book of many. And I do have some other diaries on the shelf. When I launched a film magazine in London, that was a 2-year journey. Really exciting story, which I diarized, turned into a book. The book has not been edited. I never tried to publish it. But, maybe the time is coming to get that one polished and, shooed away and next book number two, book
world,
number three, released to the world. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of excitement in that. I'm hoping, cross fingers. I've submitted my book to quite a number of rewards. Some are huge. Writer's Digest. I mean, I haven't got a hope. General nonfiction. I don't think it's going to win, but it's worth a try, worth a punt. But some of them are much more niche, and you've got a lot of sapphic book awards. And then within the sapphic realm, then you go into memoir, and some of them even have subcategories in memoir. And so I don't know, I just feel that maybe there's a book award coming down the line, and that does huge things for your book, because suddenly you've got an external vetted approval. So if you're not published by a traditional publisher, as I'm not, this is Exodai's self-published. If you get a publisher, that's the vetting. The vetting is done. People trust your book. If you're self-published, people are just a bit more wary. Self-published, it's not going to be very good, is it? But then you win a reward and it's a different story. Yeah. Then people believe in your product a bit more. So where will I be in 5 years from now? I'm afraid, Jennifer, I've been very guilty in not setting that goal. I'm pretty clear where I want to be, though it's not all written down. But I'd really like to be sort of working on my fourth or fifth book by then, having got a lot of accolades from my first book. But my real mission, I think, is to dispel the myth, the fearful myth, that being gay, perpetuated by religion, that being gay is an abomination to God. And particularly in America, this is a problem, particularly in the Middle East, with it, in Muslim tradition, it's not good to be gay. So I just would love to, if ever I became an activist, what my champion speech would be, is to dispel the fearful myth propagated by religion that being gay is an abomination to God, because that belief caused me so much heartache in my life. And it it's unbelievable how much that changed my life. Because I felt awful and disgusted about myself when I realized at age 13 I was a lesbian. And the pain that the gay community, the gay lesbian community go to, the number of suicides, especially in America, the way people have to mute and censor everything they say. Oh, I've got a partner, and they have to censor the pronouns they're using because they don't want anybody to know that actually he is dating another boy.
Yeah.
I remember so many times I'd talk joyfully about a girlfriend, but I couldn't let anyone know that she was a girl. And once I let the word she slipped out, I said, oh, no, he. I mean, just to my work colleagues and stuff. And it's just awful that people should have to go through that level of suppression in this day and age, in this progressive society. Actually, I don't know that the world is so progressive. I mean, I think they're going backwards in America, but anyway.
Just the exhaustion
of
the exhaustion of covering, and the as you say, like that internalized disgust that is so many people are having to deal with. And I'm so, it's very frustrating but also wonderful that, you know, you were able to get that beautiful answer of like, you know, well, God is the potter, you know, you are the clay, and God doesn't make mistakes. Like, what an empowering message that is.
I was very lucky that I happened to speak to such a liberal minded priest. It's not like that with everyone. I was lucky. I was lucky in many regards. My parents accepted me too. It was society at large and my own naive Christian beliefs and confronting my own sexuality at a very young, naive adolescent age. And with my own naive young adolescent interpretation of the Bible, it just set me up for all this self-loathing. That's so terrible, and it happens to so many people. I mean, really, that's why my book is for people who've been ostracized, and they're carrying this self-internalized disconnect, this internalized shame through their lives, and it's self-sabotaging. They're self-sabotaging their progress as an adult in life, whatever it is, in relationships. And if someone reading my book could look at themselves and say, oh yes, this is me, I'm in denial too, I have got a problem that I am not prepared to accept, and until I accept that there's a problem, I won't make any progress. Woody Allen said 50% of success is showing up. And I think 50% of solving a problem is acknowledging that there's a problem in the first place. So if my book helps people to see there's an internal disconnect, I need to work on this and I need to work towards self-healing, well, then my book will be a triumph for me. That would be a wonderful thing that my book has done there.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, we talked about that idea of like knowing it consciously. I accept myself, but when we don't hear right in our heart, and as you said, like at the cellular level, like that's a work to do. And so I'm thinking about what like my role is as a coach, how I can help people with that, and also how I can, you know, through the podcast be sharing different stories and showing these, here's someone who might be a reflection for you. And to say everything's okay, just show up, but also understand yourself and know where are the gaps in your acceptance of yourself too. So I feel like you may have answered my final two questions, but let's just put them out there for consistency across the podcast, which I never do. One is there anything I haven't asked you, Elizabeth, that I should have done?
Well, I thought of a couple of things when we prepared for this that I would throw back at you, but we've answered them. We've answered those questions. One was, why did I write the book? Who do I think it will help? What's the mission? And I think we've answered all of those questions already. So we're good on that one. But the second question is?
And the second question is, if the listeners of Ikigai with Jennifer Shinkai just take away one thing from this chat today, what is it that you would like them as their omiyage from our conversation?
Okay, well, I really think the most important thing is to learn to love yourself. Whatever else is going on in your life, and if you're in any kind of self-denial, or if you know there's something that consistently doesn't work, consistently is going wrong, one area of your life, whatever it is, the record keeps playing again and again and again. The history book on the shelf keeps repeating itself. You've got to look internally and saying, why am I attracting that? Why am I attracting that? Find the problem. Some of us are not even aware there's a problem. Find the problem. Why is there that disconnect internally inside me? And it's a lack of self-love. I can tell you it's a lack of self-love in one area of your life. It might be to do with your health. It might be to do with your family. It might be to do with your wealth. It might be to do with your relationships. Somewhere in your life, if there's a disconnect that keeps delivering bad experiences for you consistently, then look internally, find where the disconnect is. And it takes time. You might already know what that disconnect is and you're just in denial. Don't be in denial anymore, because solving that and learning to self-love yourself in a holistic way in all areas of your life, completely love and accept and respect yourself, is the most important thing you can do. And then the rest flows. Since I learned to love myself, I've ended up in a lovely apartment in Tokyo, a 2LDK. I live here with my sweetheart and my darling. We've been together for 5 years. It's wonderful. And my life is just so different. I look back at my relationship and I just think, gosh, what a lunatic I was. What an absolute crazy, crackpot, addicted, lunatic, frenzied, naive individual I was. And it's so clear to me now, but without learning to love myself, without going through that process, I wouldn't have come to this platform and be able to look back. And I'm not saying I love myself 100%. There are still areas about me where I haven't quite got it right, but they're not as crucially bad. If there's a really toxic part, a real toxic disconnect internally, focus on that. What is it? Why is it? Try to heal it as much as you can.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Yourself. Learn to love yourself. It's a beautiful message, and to show the impact of just focusing on that crucial and critical part and how it has that ripple effect to other things. So yeah, I'm going to be doing some journaling around that tonight.
Good. Excellent.
Yes.
Already inspired somebody.
Yes. Yes. There you go. Perfectly done. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work, Exodai, available on demand. So, when you want to get it, you can get it from
Amazon. Can I explain where people can get this?
Yes, please do.
So it's only available on Amazon. I'm afraid if you're an Amazon hater, and I know some people are, then you'll have to contact me directly and I'll arrange sending one to you. But it's Amazon. If you go into Amazon and search Exodai, it may not come up. You probably need to search Exodai Hendrick and then it should come up, or Exodai Elizabeth Hendrick. Search, because I haven't sold millions yet, so it's not coming up straight away in search. Yes. Or you can go to my website, www.exodai.co.uk.
And all of these links will be in the show notes as well.
Oh, great.
Yes, so we'll have all those links so you'll be able to get to them as well. And, as Elizabeth has shared, if you read it and when you read it and when you enjoy it, do leave a review. It really helps.
Please do. Yes.
And I would say, but just leave a 5-star review. If you didn't like it, maybe keep it mute, because that does help. So, but, reviews really help. Reviews of the podcast also really help. So please feel free to like and subscribe and all of that good stuff too. Share this. And if anything that you had as a takeaway, things that inspired you or moved you about our conversation today, please let myself and Elizabeth know. We'd love to get your feedback on this recording today as well. So thank you so much, Elizabeth. I've had a
pleasure
talking to you today, and I'm wishing you every success. And I'm going to think about you, how I can learn to love myself a little more as the days go on.
Well, thank you too, Jennifer, for having me on your podcast. I'm really grateful. It's very kind of you, and I feel very honored. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye.
Thank you so much for listening today. I really hope that you found something you could take away from the episode to help you find your own ikigai and integrate it into your daily life. And I'd love to hear exactly what resonated with you. So pop over to see me on LinkedIn or on my Facebook page. You can find the links in the show notes below. And let me know what you thought was the most important takeaway from the podcast today. And sharing is caring. So feel free to share this episode with one of your friends who you think could benefit from hearing about living a life of purpose. Looking forward to see you on the next episode of Ikigai with Jennifer Shinkai.